Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Dr. Nikki Fox, who is the Heliophysics Division Director in the Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Our next guest this morning is Matthew Cobb, who has written a new book, The Idea of the Brain, The Past and Future of Neuroscience. For thousands of years, philosophers and scientists have tried to understand what the brain, with its 86 billion neurons connected in infinite ways, does. Yet, despite the astonishing discoveries of science, we still have only the vaguest idea of how the brain works. We'll speak with Matthew about the history of brain science, but even more importantly, what current research on human brains is telling us. Matthew Cobb, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. I hope I'll be as entertaining as Nikki Fox, who is marvelous.
Well, anyone who's as excited about what they do as Nikki is will be interesting to listen to. So I'm sure you're very much the same. I mean, first of all, I just have to ask you, when I look at the title of your book, and the book was lying there on the counter when I first saw it, and I walked by it, and I said, the idea of the brain. It's almost as though we have these ideas about it, but we don't really know for sure. Is that sort of the genesis of naming the book as you did?
Well, yeah, I mean, books are odd kind of things, and titles even more so. As it happens, the title of the book came very, very late on, but it's my US publisher who came up with the idea, but it's absolutely right, because the theme of the book is partly to tell the history of thousands of years of trying to understand what's going on inside our heads. But above all, it's showing how at each time and into the future as well, the way we think about the brain, our ideas about what it is, have been largely influenced by technology and the technology of the time. So the obvious thing we'd say now is, well, the brain's a computer. So where did that idea come from? What time in the history of science and society did that appear? Why did we think that? And what did we think before? What kind of machines did we think the brain was like before? So that's part of the theme. It's about the way that science and our technology and culture interact to produce discovery and theories and concepts.
I'm sure that you've heard this a lot of times when you talk to people about the book that you've been writing and your exploration of the brain. That thing that we all heard as little kids, which was the brain, we only use 10% of our brain and the rest we just don't know anything about. It's, you know, and well, Mom, what is the other 90%? Oh, we don't know. It's like our subconscious and other things, but, you know, end of discussion. And I just think it's so funny, and it really illustrates, you know, how the masses, but also science in general, doesn't know about the brain.
Yeah, I mean, no, if anybody's any doubt, we use 100% of our brain all the time. There's not a load of, you know, billions of neurons just sitting there twiddling their thumbs. You know, it's all doing something. The question is, what exactly is it doing, and how are the various bits of our brain interconnected? So we've got some idea of some localization, what we call localization of function, that one bit of the brain does one particular thing. But even that, whenever we think we've kind of got something certain, okay, this bit of the brain does this, it turns out that in fact it's also doing something else. So for example, the cerebellum, which is right at the back of the brain and is dense in neurons, has often been thought to be involved in very simple things like balance, you know, making sure you don't fall over. But we now know it's also engaged in some quite complicated cognitive thought-based ideas, and people without a cerebellum, there are some patients who've been born without one, can survive quite well. So there's throughout the history of our understanding of brain science, there's been this continuous movement between people trying to localize particular functions to particular parts of it, and then it turns out to be a lot more complicated, and then it swings back again and so on. But above all, if you just think about it for a minute, even if that were true, even if it were, we could say, well, this bit of the brain is involved in this behavior or this concept or this way of thinking. that wouldn't tell us how it does it. A very famous neuroscientist once said, where is not how. And if you want to understand what's going on, then you need to understand how that particular set of millions, billions of neurons can work together to produce the amazing things that our brains can do.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Matthew Cobb, who's written a fascinating book, The Idea of the Brain, The Past and Future of Neuroscience. Matthew, you write in your book that we can now make a mouse remember something about a smell that it has encountered, or we could turn a bad mouse memory into a good one, even using a surge of electricity to change how that mouse perceives faces. And so you say that we stand on this brink of understanding how patterns of activity of networks of neurons create perception. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so this is some of the most recent and astonishing research that is being done that, part of the problem with the book, not a problem, but the part of the thing with the book is, on the one hand, I want to excite and amaze the public. I want you to show people what my colleagues in all sorts of areas of neuroscience are doing. On the other hand, I'm also kind of pulling the rug away a bit, or pulling the curtain back, to mix my metaphors, and saying, actually, despite this astonishing insight, we still have very little idea. So, for example, these experiments, which are able to manipulate memory in a mouse. We can only do this in a mouse, I'm glad to say, but we can make it remember something that never happened. So you can make it associate a particular part of the cage, say, with a good memory, but nothing good ever happened there. And the mouse now wants to go there. You can change a good memory of an event that actually happened into a bad memory by altering the activity of single cells in the brain of the mouse, which has got about 70 million. But just as I was explaining a minute ago, that doesn't mean that the memory is simply in that single cell. It means that we've changed the activity of a large number of cells by changing one cell in the network. It's like if you change a particular component in your computer or in your car, it behaves in a different way now, but that doesn't mean to say that the new way it behaves was encapsulated in that particular component that you've altered or replaced or taken out. So we've got this amazing sense of what's going on, and yet we still don't have a good theoretical grasp or real detailed idea about how all the bits are connected together and what kind of activity is going on in those networks. I'll just give you one example, which I use quite a bit in the book, but it brings home quite how little we understand. So you've got about 80 billion neurons in your head. A mouse has got about 70 million. Well, I want to talk to you about the lobster's stomach. And this is studied by a woman called Eve Marder, who's at Brandeis University in Boston. And she has spent her life studying the lobster's stomach, which has just 30 neurons. And these neurons work together in a network, and they produce two rhythms, and it can alternate between two states of pulsation. And that enables the muscles in the lobster's stomach to grind up its food and all the rest of it. That's the function of it. But how do those 30 cells, which aren't part of the brain, just 30 cells, how do they work together to produce the network, these rhythms? And the answer is, Dr. Marder still doesn't know. She can model the exact connections between those 30 cells. She understands everything about them, which genes are active in them, how they're connected, but she can't yet prove how the structure produces these two rhythms, nor what will happen if she removes one of those cells, how the activity will change. So if we don't understand the lobster's stomach, we've got a long way to go to understanding my brain, yours, that of a mouse, or even that of a fly.
Wow. Let me get heavy just for a moment, but I need to define something first, because our listeners and Lynn and myself, we're curious lay people. Panpsychism is a theory that all matter has some form of consciousness. We were just talking about patterns of activity in networks of neurons that may create perception. When we talk about consciousness, is it possible that if that were true, that networks of neurons create perception, that maybe, and we really have no proof for panpsychism yet, but are we starting to maybe get some proof?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, in general, I think for the last 200 years, people have accepted that in some way we do not understand, and we still don't understand, the activity of our brains produces consciousness. So this amazing experience we have, this sense, this our sensation, our feeling of being there, that is simply the product of the activity of cells in our brain. Now, how that works, I can't tell you. If I knew the answer, I'd be very rich and famous and have several Nobel Prizes. My guess is we won't understand this for centuries and centuries. But that's the materialist principle shared by virtually all neuroscientists. We don't think there's anything spooky, there's no spirit, there's nothing non-material in our heads. It is simply the product of the activity of those cells. Now, the question then comes is, well, how far down the simplicity scale do you go before that consciousness disappears? So, and I don't have the answer to that. I mean, it's really, really hard. My feeling is that it is going to be that the appearance of consciousness is something that occurs with a certain degree of complexity, but it's of the order of tens of millions of cells or even billions of cells. It's not just going to be a small number. So I don't think the lobster's stomach is conscious. And I don't think a rock is conscious, whereas people who hold to panpsychism, they kind of solve the problem of what the fact we don't understand how consciousness emerges by saying, well, everything is, which, to be honest, isn't really much of an explanation, doesn't get you very far. I'm more interested in trying to understand the principles that are involved in aspects of consciousness. So Francis Crick, the man who co-discovered the double helix in 1953, when he retired, he decided he was going to crack consciousness, and he left Cambridge and he went to California. He didn't crack consciousness, but he did change the way we think about how to go about it. When he did this in the mid-70s, study of consciousness, it was just left to kind of philosophers and undergraduates who'd smoked too much and were out under the stars together and just chant. Well, or maybe that was just me. So it wasn't taken very seriously as an academic field of study. But Crick said, look, we may not be able to understand how it all works, but we can get at one aspect of it. Can we find the activity of patterns of neurons that correlates, for example, with attention, with the fact that, you know, this individual, be it a mouse or a human, is looking at something or listening to something or smelling something. You know, attention is focus. Can we find the correlates of attention? And that would be the start. That would be the way in. Now, as it happens, we still haven't done that even in the last 35 years. But he did encourage, by having this, trying to take a simpler approach and avoiding the philosophizing, he has been able to change the way that I think scientists approach this topic.
We're speaking with Matthew Cobb. His book is The Idea of the Brain, The Past and Future of Neuroscience. And Matthew, you talk quite a bit, and I was thinking about this when you were speaking about altering the memory in using a mouse in research and altering just the one cell and thereby altering memory, how it could be applied to our own memory in terms of treating certain sorts of mental illnesses, like PTSD. Like if you could alter your memory of a situation that you had experienced a traumatic event in your life, you know, wouldn't this be the future of how we're looking at brain science?
Well, other people have got there before you. DARPA, you know, which is the big U.S. military research wing, they're very interested in this idea for precisely the reasons that you suggested, that PTSD, which is a very mysterious but extremely important phenomenon, they're interested, are there ways of effectively reprogramming the brain of the of an individual. Now, my view is that in humans, that's just not possible. And I think it's not possible technically, and I think that ethically, that's more than a can of worms. It's a whole dumpster of worms that I wouldn't want to go anywhere near, because you don't need to have read any of the novels, science fiction mm-hmm. novels of Philip K. Dick to know that this could go horribly, horribly wrong. I think that the broader problem which we have with mental health is we're in this very weird situation at the moment, because we're all aware of it, of the issue, and it's much higher on the public agenda, and we're very concerned about it, quite rightly so, in particular with our young people all over the world. And yet the techniques we have for dealing with this are really pretty poor, as anybody who themselves or has had a family member with mental health problems will know, that the treatments are very hit and miss. We're very much at the moment wedded to a kind of chemical approach. So you go and you get a pill and maybe you'll feel better. But what's striking is that all of the big pharmaceutical companies, every one of them, have closed down their research wings into psychiatric drugs to deal with depression or anxiety, because they don't think there's any money in it, because they can't be confident there's going to be a solution 30 years down the road, say, that they could then market. And I think that shows us that we really are at a very dangerous moment, a worrying moment, I would say, in that we understand the problems now much better than we used to, and we're prepared to admit to them. But we don't have the tools, the methods, the techniques for helping people in the right way. And also, everybody will have known somebody who took a particular pill and it worked great, or somebody who had a particular talking therapy and that worked great. And I fear that that's the level we're at, where it's going to be repeated attempts to try and find a solution to a particular individual's problem. And with luck, in the end, you'll hit on something.
Absolutely. I mean, you hear about this, people being treated for depression. It's like, well, try this and see how it works. You know, try it for 6 weeks or whatever it is, a month. And then I've heard of people, their depressive symptoms being exacerbated by a pill that's supposed to relieve their depressive symptoms. And that shows, as you say, how archaic really we are. And I just wanted to make the point, I was on a call yesterday, and someone brought up the fact that in our community, there has been a 40% increase during the last 2 months in needs for mental health services. And the feeling is that the mental health issues are only going to rise even as we are pulling out of this, because of the stress and anxiety related to this. And so what a sad time to be with the large pharmaceutical companies shutting down research.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I felt pretty damn miserable over the last 2-3 months that we've been locked down, for all the reasons that I'm very privileged. I'm not too old. I'm healthy, and I'm taking care of myself, and I've got my family around me. I'm not on my own. I've got friends who are completely isolated, and I know how down they've got. And I've been, Skyping them every day. The people in America, talk to them every day, to try and keep them happy. And in a way, physical contact is probably going to do, talking to somebody, at least seeing each other over Skype and just talking rubbish is going to be better and help their morale, perhaps, than taking a pill. I mean, the way I like to explain this problem we have about mental health is it's a bit like medicine before we discovered germs. So in the 19th century, scientists realized that there were just what they called germs. They didn't know what they were. They couldn't necessarily, viruses, for example, they couldn't identify them under the microscope because they're far too small. But they knew there were these infectious agents, and then they could take action against them, the kind of action we're all using at the moment, cleaning your hands. The problem with our understanding of mental health is that we're before what was called the germ theory. We don't have a theory, really, of what's going wrong when people are unwell, and if we don't have an idea of how to change things, then it's very difficult to come up with really effective treatments. And that's part of the great sadness of the current. The chapter I wrote about the mental health and the progress and the problems that remain to come was probably the most depressing thing, part of the book that I wrote, because I had to, you know, you end up thinking, well, we really don't have much idea. In a way, that wouldn't matter. So one of the things about medicine, of course, is that sometimes you find a cure and you don't know why it works. As long as it works, if you could be confident that the treatment you were giving was being effective, then in a way, it wouldn't really matter if scientists like me were saying, hey, you don't know how this works. Because as we all know from people who are unwell, then they're desperate to get better and to avoid their problems. So in a way, it wouldn't matter if we didn't fully understand, as long as these therapies worked. And that's what we need to concentrate on.
Well, Matthew Cobb is our guest, and the book is The Idea of the Brain, The Past and Future of Neuroscience. What a fascinating book. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Okay, it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Stay safe. Bye-bye.
You too.